Penguin Random House Audio presents The Urge, Our History of Addiction, by Carl Eric Fisher. Read for you by Mark Deakins. For Cat and Gus. Introduction. I'm lying in bed when I hear the commotion. I peer through the doorway of my room, and right outside, the new guy is getting in Ruiz's face. There's a phone right outside the door, one of those sturdy metal payphones. It looks like it's been carried in from the street. And Ruiz, a gentle older man with shoulders stooped by the demoralization of his nth relapse and hospitalization, is just trying to talk to his family. But the new guy has been manic and pacing since he arrived a few hours ago, and he won't take no for an answer. I watch the new guy stalk the other way across the doorway, muttering to himself, menacing even in retreat. Then a warning shout echoes from much too far in the distance, and he appears once again, flying near horizontal, to tackle Ruiz, dragging him off the phone. The staff quickly take him down. Thankfully, no one was seriously hurt. Shaken, I try to focus on my journal, but my mind races. My roommate, a burly, middle-aged guy with a scar down the side of his head, attesting to the brain injury that's brought him back here over and over again, turns to me laconically and says, "There goes dinner." I'm 29 years old, writing in my journal in a sloppy felt-tip pen, no ballpoints are allowed, trying to understand how I went from being a newly minted physician in a psychiatry residency program at Columbia University to a psychiatric patient at Bellevue, the city's notorious public hospital. Bellevue is synonymous with the most challenging chronic mentally ill cases, and now I'm locked on the dual diagnosis ward on the 20th floor, near the top of the building, where they put people who have both substance use problems and other mental disorders. I've already recognized some of the faculty from when I applied here for residency, and I know from the tour I took as an applicant that the special prison ward, protected by a guardhouse with bulletproof glass and thickly barred gates, is a floor below us. I need that phone those two men were fighting over. It's my only way to reach the outside world, that other plane of reality where I was once a psychiatry resident. I'm having trouble accepting that I belong here, not there. Day by day, it seems more likely that what the doctors have been telling me is correct, that just like the new guy, I too have had a manic episode, in my case induced by weeks of stimulants and alcohol. But I'm still not sure what I should do. The next day, I meet with the whole treatment team, half a dozen psychiatrists, therapists, and counselors facing me across a massive table in one of those windowless hospital conference rooms. For the first time, I truly let my guard down and recount my whole drinking history. How I grew up with two alcoholic parents and swore to myself I'd never be like them. How, even as I finished medical school at Columbia, I had the creeping sense that my drinking was out of control. How the blackouts got more and more frequent, but I didn't reach out for help, and I didn't accept the help that friends, colleagues, and supervisors had all offered, then implored me to take. I tell them everything, even the one time that I woke up on the floor of the hallway in my building, shirtless, my skin sticking to the tacky linoleum, locked out of my own apartment. It was only by getting up to the roof and climbing down the fire escape that I made it into work that day at all. I was late again, and so ashamed and scared by what it said about me. It was obvious that something was wrong, but I never told anyone about it, because to do so would be to acknowledge what I had long suspected. They ask me about my family, and I tell them about my father's four rehabs and the bottles of wine my mother secreted around the house. I describe my parents as alcoholics, as I usually do, but I also finally give voice to that dangerous suspicion about myself. And I'm starting to realize that I'm an alcoholic too. And I break down crying. Despite all this, later that weekend, I call my friend Ravi from that payphone, looking down the disorientingly long hallway that stretches the whole length of the ward. He's helping me with all the logistics, setting up disability insurance, getting my rent paid, and generally making it possible for me to go to rehab, a place I don't quite want to go to, but I'm told that I need. We talk about how it'll be good for me, and how I've struggled for so long. His voice is strained. It's clear he's worried about me. So I hesitate for a moment. I have the clear sense of telling myself, this is a truly ridiculous question. Don't ask him this. But then ask him anyway, even as I keep one eye down the hallway for any potential assailants. Do you really think I can never drink again? I'm supposed to be headed to some specialized rehab for doctors, but I know nothing about it. I want to go, but not really. I need help. But maybe I can do it on my own, or at least find a better way. Why is this so hard? I did go to that rehab for doctors, and in time, I returned to the residency program at Columbia. For years afterward, I was in supervised treatment. At a moment's notice, I had to be prepared to run across the medical center or across town to my urine monitor, a woman who would watch me urinate to make sure I didn't try to pass off someone else's bodily fluids as my own. As I slogged through half a decade of this, I got more curious. I knew that the addiction treatment system was broken, having experienced it firsthand, but the why was mystifying. Why was there a totally separate system for addiction treatment? Why do we treat addiction differently from any other mental disorder? If everyone seems to know that the system is broken, why isn't anyone changing it? I decided to become an addiction medicine specialist. In a surreal twist, as I studied psychotherapy and medications, I was also going to my own treatment and meetings and generally trying to work out what recovery meant to me. As I finished training and joined the psychiatry and bioethics faculty at Columbia, the worst seemed to be behind me. But as I emerged from those revitalizing yet profoundly disorienting years, the same questions lingered insistently. How did I get here, and what exactly had gone wrong in me? Or, as patients often ask, what happened to me? Why am I like this? How do I get better? In search of answers, I immersed myself in the field, studying the psychology and neuroscience of addiction. I wanted to find the right definition, the correct and tidy medical theory that would explain it, but I was soon overwhelmed. The field seemed to be in chaos. Scientists and other scholars seemed bitterly divided, always talking past one another. Some insisted that addiction was primarily a brain disease. Others claimed that this brain-centric view blinded us to the psychological, cultural, and social dimensions, including trauma and systems of oppression. Few other fields of medicine are so powerfully driven by cultural bias and ideology. Everyone seemed to have their own take, as did every field of study. One summary of theories of addiction listed no fewer than 30 different models, from psychological concepts to neurobiological mechanisms to economic models of choice, and those are just the ones deemed respectable today. Each one of them had something useful to add, but more often than not, their answers felt demoralizingly incomplete. I began working in psychiatry, not incidentally, at a time of increasing disillusionment with the simplistic view that all of human suffering could be reduced to neurobiology. President George H.W. Bush had designated the 1990s the decade of the brain, but during the 2000s and into the early 2010s, as I finished my training, there were signs that neuroscience, while useful and even revolutionary in some ways, was not sufficient to explain the complex phenomena of mental suffering. Researchers were still trying to make sense of what it meant to call something a mental disorder, and the picture was yet more complicated in the case of treatment. Antidepressants were nowhere near as useful as the first generation of heady advertisements had promised. Biotech companies were slashing funding and even shuttering their neuroscience research divisions altogether.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?